I am the village philosopher here this week. At home, I live in the area of Washington, D.C., and work as the director of life enrichment services for Lutheran Social Services. It's geared as a way to enable people to live with some more satisfactions to dealing with the kinds of things that become the conflicting things in life. Amongst the things that I have been interested in have been the issues of how people might be able to find themselves closer to each other. When I chose the title for this afternoon, The Search for Intimacy, I was influenced some by an article by a fellow by the name of husband and wife, and I can't think of his first name. Mace is his last name. Vera is his wife's name. David, thank you. David and Vera Mace. And it was an article entitled The Love-Hate Cycle. The article is based on the fact that love and hate are really two different sides of the same coin. In other words, if you have the coin, you can be looking from one side to the other. Now, I would like to set this in the context of our sense of growth. And as I see it, there's a double journey that we go on. One is the search for myself as God has made me. And the other is for the search of myself as God has made me in the context of those who are around me. I am disinclined to separate these as being one a psychological journey and the other a spiritual journey, because I've a long time ago believed that some of these dichotomies or splits in us tend to be less than helpful. My inclination is to believe that I am one. And I pick up this pattern perhaps maybe from God himself as he has made me. But the tasks about which I go sometimes have different directions. One of those directions is to know myself, to understand myself, to come to understand that. The other is to understand those who are around me. Now, the search for intimacy, I began thinking about this in terms of trying to enable couples to survive each other for a longer number of years with greater satisfaction. I don't believe that it's limited, though, to the issue of trying to just think in terms of the close relationship of marriage, but I think it also has to do with some friendship kinds of things. So that whether you're married or whether you're single, it seems to me that there's some of the things here that fit together. I'm thinking about this also in terms of the congregation where I am a member. Esther and I are members in a congregation that presently is vacant. And one of the things that I've had a feeling about with the call committee and have tried to verbalize to them is that one of the things sometimes that we try and do is to figure out how we can call the perfect pastor. Being ordained, I understand, really, there is no such thing. I don't know whether you've seen the what is it called? Chain letter. That if you don't like your pastor, send him to 12 other congregations, and they will in turn send you theirs. The idea being that by the time you're all done, you will have spread everybody's misery all over the map. Perfection isn't there. My guess is that I would like to see in the call process, rather than our trying to outsmart God, to try and somehow figure if we can find a pastor that we think we can survive. And then learn to build a relationship between that person and the congregation. Now, you think maybe that sounds strange. My belief is that marriage and friendship is built on the same base. We get together on the basis of our samenesses, but it's on the basis of our differences that we grow. Now, I suspect that some of you are thinking, hey, don't we tend to marry opposites? That isn't what I'm talking about here. I don't think that's what this phrase, which is not original with me, I don't think that's what that one is geared to. I think what it's saying is this, is that we think that we are enough alike in order to be able to survive living together. And that's about all you know. Esther and I did not know each other as children. We met each other when you finished high school, I guess, and I was in college or finishing college just before I went to seminary. And one of the things that I wondered about was that she came from a background, she lived in a different part of the town than I did. There was no church relationship that was in common. She was Episcopalian, I was Lutheran. But that fit because when I was in seminary, they said, never marry a Lutheran, otherwise you don't extend the church. But I thought about the fact, you know, that she was a Christian. The Episcopal Church is a liturgical church. Those things are in common. But really the issues, and I don't know as I've rather ever really pressed her to see how she felt about this particular issue of can we survive each other, but I think that was there. We were able to get married because we felt that we were alike enough that we could be able to stay together some. Okay, that's what I understand as sameness, meaning that we think that here is somebody that we can survive. I think that applies to all kinds of relationships. I think it applies to the most intimate of relationships, or what I would hope would be the most intimate of relationships in marriage. But I think it also applies to friends. We choose our friends on the same base. I think it would have to do, as I said, in choosing perhaps the clergy along with a parish. I think it has to do with whether or not I think I can survive a job. I've learned in going to school, that's one of the things that I do is I choose the course, but I also choose the professor, whether or not I can survive the professor. All of those kinds of things enter into life. But now, when you bring it down to the closeness of relationship, of close relationships, you get into a thing that happens that you eventually are going to run into these differences. And they tend to be profound ones. They are always there. The honeymoon is a time, whether it's between a pastor and a congregation or between spouses. A honeymoon essentially is a time when it seems we tend to try and not bring up the big issues, even though they're there. Part of it is, let's see if we can't get this thing off the ground and going. And then if we can, and have some established base of difference, then maybe we, of sameness, then maybe we can take on some of the differences. Generally, for example, we manage. But I remember one friend that on the second day out, they got into some ferocious arguments. Ferocious, not in the sense that they were physically tearing each other apart, but they were really blockbusters. I mean, they got into the place where they couldn't move at all. One of the things that we seemed to know right away was the chances for that relationship were going to be pretty close to about 2% chance of success when you start in that quick with no chance really to build any kind of a base. Well, now, the issue becomes more important, and David Mace points to this in his article, because it used to be that we had things that held us together. For example, we had male and female tasks Fiddler on the Roof. The husband asks his wife, do you love me? And she sings back to him, do I love you? You know, that's a strange question. I wash your clothes, I've raised your kids, I've cooked the food. What do you mean, do I love you? Meaning simply that she was saying, in a sense, they were sticking together because that was necessary. Some of you grew up on a farm, and they tell me that this is one of the things where the tasks have to be shared on the farm. Now, David says we don't have much of that today. I think he's a little bit wrong, because I've discovered such a thing as a mortgage that is powerful in trying to keep people both working like mad to try and make those payments. But that really isn't enough, it seems to me. What happens is that when we get into our differences, what happens with them? Let's see. Sometimes what happens with them is that we just don't know how to handle them. When we don't know how to handle them, we just simply come to a power exchange where one faces up to the other, and there you are, butt face to butt. You are looking at the other person and saying, I'm stronger than you are. Sometimes we use negotiating stuff. Even sex is used that way. If you don't do what I want, you get no sex. If you don't do what you want, let's see, the one I saw was where the husband and wife had an argument, and he was knocking outside the door if he could come in, and she had a bucket of water sitting on top of the door, and she said, yeah, come on in, come on in. She was going to level it out as he came in with a bucket of water. But how do you settle these conflicting differences becomes the issue. You have three choices, as far as I know it, when you get into a conflict. One is that you can cave in, give in. For the sake of the relationship, I won't argue it. I will accept it and I will go along. Where are we going to go on vacation? Well, I want to go here, I want to go there. One can say, I'm going to go along with you, and that's it. The second would be to split, to withdraw. I'm not going to go with you over there. You go there, and I'll go there. That would be a split. The other would be to face up to the other person. It's called confrontation. And confrontation has two styles. One is where you try and overwhelm the one person with what I would call power, to simply overload them. That power works something like the story that you've heard, I'm sure. Where does a 3,000-pound gorilla sleep? Anybody know? Any place he wants. That's called power. And that's one way that you can solve it. But another kind of power is where, instead of one overwhelming the other, what you do is you confront. And this is where you begin to work with these differences in such a way that you could arrive at something which is not, let me put it the negative way, not destructive to either one. Now, the basis on which we might approach that is, now let me pick up again on David Mace's article, in which he said, when we get into our differences and we love a person, sometimes we suddenly discover that we have turned that coin, and because of the differences, we are very angry. Now, sometimes that's a surprise for us. We think true love never gets angry, never has anger involved in the relationship. My assumption is that, if you don't ever get angry, you're never talking about anything of significance. Or somebody's always caving in. Again, let me use it in terms of marriages. I maybe would be facetious with this, but I think every once in a while I run into somebody who tells me they have never argued as a couple. And I figure two things possibly is true. One is that they aren't living together. The other is that one is always caving in to the other. I think that the growth that comes from facing up to differences is going to make for stress and struggle. I don't see any problem with it. The issue is if we allow the stress or struggle to become destructive to either one of us. Let's see, I don't want to be a perfectionist there. All struggle carries hurt with it. All stress and confrontation is going to cause pain and setback. And I don't think there's any way to avoid that. And I don't think that that's something that we have to say we should never do. Because I don't know how you really work differences out, if they are real, without that. I have learned that as I look back on things that I've discovered out of a lot of pain and a lot of stress that comes with that, some of the greatest growth for me personally has come. I don't say that this invites me or you to be masochists. In other words, to go looking for pain. That would be an aberration, I think, of what we ought to be and how we would go at it. But I think that I've learned enough that if I know that something is going to bring pain, that is not a signal for me any longer to turn around and walk away. That I can receive pain and I can grow out of pain. Either to know that I was dead wrong, or once in a blue moon, dead right, but probably more than not, onto something into which there was some truth, and out of which I can grow to greater truth. I think the richness of my life, I would say, has to do with the fact that Esther has stood up to me at times when it was appropriate. And there were times when I think I stood up to her, but I think it's more the other way, just the way our personalities are. So I'm trying to be honest, Esther. You can check it with her if some of this comes out, looks skewed. But by standing up to it, by working things through, there came a way in which there was some growth. Well, now, back at this issue of anger. Anger is there, and as a Christian, I think I at least ought to be able to be honest about who I am and where I am. And so part of that is to say, yes, I am feeling angry. There are different ways in which you can deal with anger. One way in which I can deal with anger is to act it out. I can flail things about. I can be destructive. I can smash things up. I can do all kinds of things like that. David May says that one of the first things in building a close relationship, whether it is in a marriage relationship or whether it's in a friendship, one of the first things is that I would say that anger is inappropriate in this flaying and reaching out and smashing things up. It's inappropriate. Now, he's not saying that those feelings are not real. I'm going to separate that out. He's just saying to take that anger and use it in a destructive way. We need to somehow say to ourselves, that's inappropriate. The base is that when I get angry and frustrated because I am opposed, and I presume the same thing happens for you, that you suddenly come up against something where assumptions on my part are questioned, where what I want to do, actions are opposed, that's a frustration. I can come up and look at that and see that anybody who is opposing me represents the enemy. And then what, as a human being, I do is look at as an enemy is to see how I can overcome that enemy, which generally means to either pound them into the ground, if you have enough power to do it, or to destroy them, in some way make their position untenable. It's called the put-downs. I grew up in a family of three boys, and in the competitive way that I remember somewhat being raised was that one way in which you controlled somebody was to put them down, make them feel so lousy they wouldn't be willing to take on the fight any further. We had a lot of learning to do that in our marriage. That's another thing that happens, by the way, is that we bring the baggage from the interpersonal stuff that we've learned as we've grown up to depending on sometimes where we are in that family scale of oldest child or whatever, and where the boys and girls are, and how we learn to deal with boys and girls, and we bring that stuff along. But one of the ways that we can do is to be destructive and in that way overcome it. But what David is suggesting is that if you want to build a marriage or a friendship or any kind of closeness to a person, what you do is you begin by declaring that anger poured out on another person is inappropriate. Now, the reality of it is that no matter how high a commitment we have to trying to overcome anger, it's going to be there and it's going to come out. The most important gift that God has given us in that respect is the gift of forgiveness. A, to ask for it, and B, to receive it. Or reverse, you know, to give it when it's asked for. Sometimes we feel, hey, I wish I would never, act like that again. And for me, I see that as really the base for frustration sometimes, is that a person thinks that you can suddenly turn your life around. And there are times when it does happen, but my experience is in a lot of cases, it's more like a zigzag, and we keep changing direction. And that the issue is the direction in which you're going, not where you are. That is my understanding on a spiritual journey. The third thing that he suggests, the first was that anger be declared as not appropriate, because we are not looking at an enemy. The second is then to declare that anger has a purpose, because we're looking at a difference. Now the third is to work on it. To work on it is not an easy task. When we try and work on things sometimes, what happens maybe for you as it's happened for us is that we get to the place that I remember sometimes saying, when I felt so frustrated as we tried to work on something and I got to the level of frustration about what I could take, I remember saying sometimes, well, that's the last time I'm ever going to bring that up again. Meaning that the difference hasn't gone away. What we've done is decided that that one is something that we're incapable of working up, and we're going to put that up in the closet shelf and close the door. It creates a Fibber McGee closet, if anybody of you go back in radio to those days. When every time during the program, Fibber would go to his closet and open it, and then they would have an avalanche of sound as everything that he'd stuffed in there came pouring out. Well, human ways, that's also true, is that we get so much stuff in the closet. Now, part of my understanding of what intimacy is that if I've got too much stuff in the closet with my spouse or my friends, too much stuff that we can't talk about, there's not much chance of our becoming very intimate. Intimacy somehow has the relationship between what we don't have to put in the closet. Now, I'd like to put it that way. Some things we can learn sometimes to take back out of the closet and start to rework. But the first steps are sometimes really trying to find some way in order to not have to put things in those closets. That if we can learn some way to deal with some of the differences that come up, the road to intimacy lies along the line of being able to confront the issue in such a way that we can both try and deal with it, and out of it find something that we can both live with. Now, this is the third step then. Eschew anger, knowing I'm not facing an enemy, and knowing that by dealing with it over a period of time, is the road to growth. That I gain some insights, that I gain some knowledge. But to me, the real issue, at least for me, has been that by working through differences with my spouse, my friends, and colleagues with whom I work, has meant that I have almost inevitably gained some insight, caught a glimpse of something that I didn't catch before. It seems to me that that's part of the experience that maybe you can have while you're here at Holden, is that if you can wrestle with somebody intellectually and spiritually who is making one of the presentations, that particularly if you find yourself up against something that looks like, hey, I don't like that, it looks so different, But the issue is that out of our difference, we can grow. And to the extent that that can be engaged with that person, it seems to me you have a chance to gain an insight. And those insights come with sometimes a quick flash. Oh, I don't know whether you've done that, but I have. Sometimes audibly and sometimes silently. I just suddenly know all of a sudden a bit of a light came on for me. If you get enough little lights in a hallway, eventually you get enough light there that you can see to walk down it. And it, in some ways like this, this is how I perceive life. I would add one more thing here, and that's in terms of its process. I value the fact that over these years, I'm just over 60 now, and one of the things that nobody ever told me about getting older, the things they told me about was that your body will go to pot, and it has. But the issue of illness and so on, you know, all the ugly things, as it were, about age, and I've discovered that even those aren't, because somebody said just because you have a handicap, it does not necessarily have to become a disability. But one of the things that has been very helpful is that now as I look back, there have been enough of these little lights coming on in the hallway that I've seen enough now that there's a way to walk. And I understand it as a gift of faith. So part of that is staying with it and working with it and the process of getting there. Okay. If we look at, and let me take this step and then let's just open it to kicking around some of the things that you want, because I'm trying to do this in such a way that it can speak to what I believe is the closest, most intimate relationship in life, which is that of spouses, but also to friendships and also to working with other people. I'd want to see it, and I see it work that broadly. But I'd like to keep it at the point of how can we work on it to build that closeness that we are really all searching for. We really want to be loved and to be loved. And in that drive, it seems to me, is that we're looking for someone who will care enough that when they discover differences, they will not turn and walk away. That they care enough about us as to think there may be something in that that's worthwhile, to stay and work on it. That kind of commitment, it seems to me, is what allows us then to be able to get at that in terms of growth. Now, in trying to work through anger in such a way that it tends to be non-destructive, it seems to me, first of all, trying to get clear where I am and what it is that I'm perceiving about me. There's a group that has done some thinking about how we understand ourselves, and they've suggested five parameters that you might use for getting in touch with and understanding what it is that is going on for you. And let me just put those here. The first is sensory, or sense. Second is interpretation. Third is emotion. Fourth is intention. And the fifth is action. I can become aware of where I am. Okay, I just had a sensory experience. Did you get it, Arthur? My interpretation was I was sitting on the eraser. Now, this is a good example to work from. This is the first thing that came to my attention. I experienced something through the senses. And then the next thing that happened was that I made an interpretation. I was sitting on the eraser because at that point I remembered that I had laid it over here in the stool. Notice I got up and then sat down. I thought, well, maybe I can sit it out like a chicken. And I decided, no, there's no need that I have to sit it out. And it also occurred to me I could use it as a way to clarify the awareness for John. Okay? My intention was, I just told you, to try and clarify how it is that we perceive things. I am also aware now that I'm holding the eraser in my hand and I'm standing on the side of the stool. So I can, it's much nicer this way, I discovered that the air is better up here and I can see better. But now, when you get into some things, this process that I've just demonstrated is a process that's an important process. Sometimes you will best get into this when you discover that you have blown off, gotten angry, didn't like it, and you're going to do some thinking about it. And one of the things that I found that is helpful is that if I can sit down and not take on that issue. Now, this applies, for example, in my work where I will have a disagreement with somebody. I'll say, I'll talk to you later. And what I'll do is I'll go back and sit down, sometimes with pencil and paper, and sometimes just sit and think. And what I'll try and do is walk through this. Now, it starts different places with different people. Frequently, I find for me, I start with an interpretation, meaning I am totally unaware of what sensory data has come to me that has made for that interpretation. So one of the things that I start with sensory data is, what did that person say to me? Now at that point, I try and reconstruct. Did I hear them say, I'm not sure I can pick anything up like this very quickly right now. But did I hear them say that they would not? Or if I think about it, did I hear them say they weren't sure whether they cared to or not? World of difference. My interpretation was, if I would say they would not was, my interpretation would be they really have a closed mind on this. But if I check the sensory data, what in fact did I hear? Then maybe I get in touch with something different. If that is true, then I also ought to get in touch with what my emotions are. That emotion thing is very helpful because it can run the gamut from that I am surprised, hurt, shook, or threatened. And the threatened one is the toughest, and I need to get in touch with that. Am I feeling threatened by that? For example, that some of my turf is going to be invaded. Meaning, as far as turf is concerned, some of my meanings on that would be that I would be expected to do something that I cannot do. I don't like to fail. I've gotten to the place that I've learned that it's better to say no and not try something that I now know I cannot do and wait it out perhaps or learn another skill, but to be able to sort that out. So one of the things that for me I could say is I was threatened by that. Or to say that I'm really feeling uncomfortable because I don't want to work on that issue. Now the word uncomfortable is the emotion there. My intention, what I want out of it. I've discovered sometimes that my intention was that I really wanted to sink what was going on. Now, if I didn't admit that to me, I would not be able to deal hopefully with a situation. And that oftentimes allows for a recycling of the whole thing. Do I really want to scuttle it? Is that what's going to make me feel good or bad? And if so, then I have to start over again. Action is an awareness sometimes that will help me get in touch with the rest of it. There are times when I've said I wasn't anxious about something, and Esther would say, well, then why aren't you sleeping very well? Okay? I was denying, my sensory data wasn't picking up what in fact was happening. And so that to get in touch with this sometimes is to see where all the other things are. I've sensed, for example, I've stopped and realized that sometimes I was getting kind of knots in my tummy. And all of a sudden, then that's where I entered into this awareness thing for me. I became aware here, and then I began to think, hey, if I have knots, what is it that is happening that's making me feel this way? So that the awareness that I have is a very helpful way to begin to discuss something. Now, if I've gone and sat down and done some of this thinking and gotten in touch with me, that's a beginning for you to sit down with a friend or a compatriot or somebody that you're working with or your spouse to begin now. Let's to see if we can talk about what's going on. Now, it's helpful if both people who are involved in the conversation can get in touch with as much of this data as possible. That's a very important, helpful thing. It'll move things more quickly. Even if both don't, if you have been the one who has taken the lead and has gotten in touch with this, it's very important for you, if you're going to understand your friend or your partner, to get in touch with all of this if it isn't being expressed. Here, Frank asked, was this going to be a how-to session? And it isn't always how-to, but one of the things that I'm aware of is that as you go for this data, you can do it in such a way that it's a turn-off or that allows you to work on it. If you come on in such a way that you're attacking, challenging, it tends to shut it down. And it tends to be where you are using what are called closed questions, where you're asking a question as to why are you so slovenly on Tuesdays? You know, that's a closed question. I don't even talk about that one because you're making an assumption about me. But if you wanted to discover what's going on for John at this point, if you would say, John, what kind of emotions or feelings go on for you on a Tuesday afternoon when it's raining? That would allow me to talk to you and not feel threatened. So it's that kind of open stuff that we go at. Now, let me see if I can summarize this much, and then let's just open it up and see where the clarities are or not. The search for intimacy is the search for trying to be close to people. What I didn't say earlier, and I guess ought to be said at this point, is that sometimes I've discovered people have felt that to be involved in sex with a person is to be close to them. It's only one kind of closeness, called sexual intimacy. But when that no longer is the excitement that it once was, if that's all the intimacy you have going, you don't have it. That intimacy can include that, but that the closeness that allows a relationship to exist has to exist in that which allows me not only to feel it's gone, the sameness, the comfort with that, but above all to be able to know that it is in our differences that we can and do grow to greater closeness as we work those through. And that in that search for intimacy, the task is to try and get in touch with me and where I am, to try and do the same thing with my friend, my spouse, my compatriot, with a sense that they are not the enemy. Now, I'm not saying that we don't ever have enemies. I've run into people who were out to kill me, psychologically or otherwise. And I do know that this is very helpful. I mean, this is, you know, when Jesus says, love your enemies, I think this is where you apply that. And I wish we were doing more of that with Russia, for instance, to try and understand where they're coming from. But I want to try and reach out through this to understand them in order to move that conflict with a sense that God has made something that is unique in all of us so that, as somebody said, we are all greater. Let's see, what's that phrase? We're together we are greater than we are separate. In other words, it's the totality, the community, the sense of the total of the church. So that the search for intimacy is then to take seriously this reaching through differences, working at them in some such way of both understanding myself and the other person, that we can find some ways to grow with it. Now, let's just open it to any kind of what doesn't make sense to you or where you want to maybe comment or expand. Okay, the question is, how do I define growth? I guess I would, I've never thought about this before, so I'm going to think out loud. For me, growth is to become more than I presently am. Meaning I've gained insights and understandings or abilities that were perhaps lying latent or non-existent in my life. So growth is that by which I move to be a more complete person, able to receive and know more of what God has made around me. So growth is in that sense, not just change for the sake of change. Does that satisfy, or do you have another idea? Okay, thank you, Fran.
Sounds in your five up there. It sounds like listening is an important thing. Listening to your senses, listening to how you're interpreting, listening to the other person.
Yes.
Listening to your emotions.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the hardest of all the relational skills to learn.
She's saying listening is foundational and that it's one of the hardest skills to learn, and that's true. The issue oftentimes when you get in a fight is to believe that you're right and the other person is wrong, and if they only shut up and listen to you, we can get this thing straightened out. So it's the last thing we come to, because we have to somehow, or try to believe that we are right and they are wrong. One of the assumptions ought to be is that maybe we're both right. This raises one other thing. Let me put it this way. Sometimes the spiritual journey is to be available to other people. Way back when I was beginning in youth work, Mary Schramm's dad, Marcus Rieke, was director of the youth program, and at each of the events we had, I remember one of the chief phrases that I kept learning was, whoever would be chief among you, let him be your servant. And it's that balance that brings to the other, which sometimes Christians have to learn, and that is to stick up for yourself. You have to put those two together. In my growing up, one of the things I had to learn to do was to try and get a decent self-image about myself, to believe about me. That was where most of my work came from. I had learned how to be a servant. I had no problem with that at all. Because I felt, that I wasn't so good, and that one of the ways I could be useful in this world was simply to become the servant. And that's a spiritual kind of thing. It swings. Now, maybe if you're a person who has really learned to take care of yourself, but do not have sensitivities to other people, maybe that other side has to be learned. But listening is one of the places where you become available as a person to other people around you in a way that is absolutely invaluable. John Hopkins University, way back 20 years ago, produced a robot that delivered the mail up and down the halls of this great big building in the physics lab. And one of the things that they built into this robot was that when the battery got low, it was capable of finding an electric outlet, plugging itself in, and recharging. Well, one of the things is that there are times when we are in the spot that we really want to plug in somewhere to get recharged. And you try and find somebody who will listen to you. That's one of the ways in which I've gone at this. I remember there was a time in my life when I didn't have anybody that I thought would listen to me in a non-judgmental way. And I was not emotionally at that point able to take any kind of destructive judgment. And I remember working for about 5 to 6 weeks with newsprint, in which I tried to talk to me. I tell you, it was a painful experience because, try and keep those two routes open. But one of the things that I think came clear for me was that one of the gifts that you and I have to give to each other sometimes is just to be a listener. And what I've learned about listening is it's not just to sit there and to be a bump on the log with them. Listening somehow means to be able to hear without distorting. And that's important. It's so easy for me sometimes to let my perceptions and my needs get into the picture and it distorts what somebody's saying. But I'm just trying to take the issue of what Fran is saying here and trying to underline it. If you're going to be here at Holden Sunday a week, I think I'm right on that. It'll be Christmas in July at Holden. And one of the goals at Holden with an alternative Christmas is to think about alternate ways of giving. And alternate ways of giving can be ways in which you don't have to go and buy something. One of the things that I've tried there's all kinds of mix-up in this one, but let me risk it if I can surface it, is that one of the things I've said years ago is that I don't care for Mother's Day. Not that I'm against mothers. But I decided, you know, that's a heck of a time to say that once I care about you. It would be better in my head to try and make anything that would be appropriate for that day happen at least once a week through 52 weeks. So that an alternate kind of giving might be that you might give yourself and, you know, available to just be a listener or a follower to somebody that you care about. In other words, say, I'm going to give you, what, 12 days a year? And you can use them at your discretion. And if you want to protect yourself, you can say 12 days of 8 hours each. And, you know, just make that available. They can mark it off or whatever. But this listening thing is one of the cheapest things in terms of actual dollars, but one of the most valuable things, it seems to me, we can give to each other. So you touched a nerve for me, Fran. That's why I'm spilling so much. Listening, I think, is so important. Frank?
I'd like to piggyback on that, too, because I think you're talking about intimacy. We're talking about interpersonal relationships between two people. So I think while I have a responsibility to listen to Maxine or other people in my life, I think I also have a responsibility to tell them, to communicate to them some things. And when I look at the five that you have up there, the one that is hardest for me is the emotion one. I can usually tell her what I heard from her and how I interpret it and what my intention is and what my action's going to be. But I'm not often willing to admit what my emotions are about that, because they might be guilt or anger or other things that don't feel good and that I don't feel vulnerable enough to release and talk about. So I think it's important to not only for us to listen for those kinds of things, but also be willing enough to be open and vulnerable to share of ourselves with others.
Okay, did you hear that over there? The willingness to be open and sharing. And you use that word vulnerable. Seems to me what allows for intimacy. I figure that now the intimacy between Esther and I is greater than with anybody else in my life, because she knows enough to kill me anytime she wants. She knows I am totally vulnerable. She knows my weaknesses. And if she wanted to make shredded wheat out of me in front of you, she could do it anytime she wanted. But the thing that allows for closeness and caring between us is that I don't think she'll do it. She hasn't in all these 400 years we've been married. Yes?
My wife and I have a good relationship. I tell her what to do and she tells me where to go.
And there are some things that stand there. And that's standard, you know, in a relationship. If there are things, though, that you want to get out of that cycle and pull in and get out of the closet, then there are other options. But sure, I think we do have to stand to each other and not let for us not to be caring about each other, to push each other. She's saying, if you push me around, she's going to say no. And that's needed, because that makes her then a respected member of your relationship.
I might just add that my husband has kept it in
mind. Okay. But I hope you also have the sense of humor to tell him where to go sometimes. Yes, Maxine.
You said earlier, early on, that in the relationship, you know, if someone says they've never had a fight, that you would, first of all, ask if they're living together. And I forgot what the second one was. In the bed or something?
Pretty close to it. That means one person is always caving in to the other.
My mother lost her husband, and there was a tremendous amount of pain involved in that, and a tremendous amount of pain. And then she met this man who had nurtured a wife who had died of cancer for 10 years. For 10 years, she became terminally ill, and so on. So they both had gone through a lot of pain. And when they married, it was like it was the most tremendous relationship I have ever seen in my whole life. And they married only 4 years, and they knew each other for 1 year before getting married, and then he died of a heart attack. And I talked to her about that, and I said, Mom, I said, you and John never had much to fight, did you? And she said, we were too precious to each other, living each day, because we knew each other. And I've never forgotten that. I think that's a beautiful way to look at a relationship. I can remember in our early marriage, so much having to pick up my socks off the floor. And I used to, you know, and having to put these PJs up on the door. And I used to resent that. I'd get so angry, and I'd find all kinds of ways, slamming at the door to let him know I was struggling way more at this time, and so on. And finally, it struck me, and it was really when I began to read Corinthians 13, 1 Corinthians 13, about love and what love is, and got into the Bible. And I found that instead of resenting, I can pick up those socks and pick up the pajamas and embrace them to me and say, thank you, God, that I've got friends for today. And it was a combination of what my mother told me, what God has to say about unconditional love, that somehow I was just deflated of all that, you know, resentment, that dumb resentment that affected other little things. I looked for other little nitpicky things I get upset about.
All right, what you're saying is that you found that things like picking up socks and pajamas were not so that you couldn't survive that. You could, and you found not only that it was possible to do that, but you found by taking those things and holding them to you, it was a way of remembering something different about Frank, so that once what was repugnant, repulsive, irritating was now acceptable.
Right. And okay. Likewise, I know that I sometimes am a slob in the car and leave my things all over, and he doesn't get real upset about that, whereas he used to be very upset about that. And it's been after, you know, 19 years of marriage, I think that we've begun to just not be so picky about the little things anymore.
Okay. Now there, for the rest of you, learning not to get picky about the little things. One of the things that most of us believe is that, particularly with marriage, that if we have enough sameness, and God lets us get married, that after we get married, we'll get the other person straightened out so they'll be okay. That's around, isn't it? Huh? And part of what you're saying is that you're not going to approach it that way, because it tends to become destructive. If we can accept that we are unique and different, and that's been the gift of God, that's what you said with those, then what you are able to do, though, is to learn that some things are important and others are not to you. I want to add that, because for somebody else, those socks and pajamas may be very important. I don't want to lay a trip on anybody to say that that has to be your unimportant stuff. But the issue is, if you can decide what are the important issues that you want to work through with your partner and let a lot of other stuff go as a gift of God, and then work on the important things, you have a chance to work it through. If you're, and you use the word nitpicking, nitpicking is the kind of thing where there is just so much bitching going on the part of both in the marriage, that there isn't much happiness left. The Christian life, with God and with those who are around us, is intended to have joy in it.